From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as the UN World Conference on Women continues, we talk with reporter Vicky Kuei, who is in Beijing. And we discuss how women's movements have become more local and global with political scientist Amrita Basu. She's edited a collection of essays on women's movements around the world. Also, dancing in the face of illness and death. We talk with choreographer and dancer Bill T. Jones. His piece, Still Here, is based on his conversations with people across the country who are dealing with life-threatening illness. Jones is HIV positive. And world music critic Milo Miles tells us about China's most popular rock star. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The largest women's conference in history is in progress in China. Delegates to the 4th UN Conference on Women are gathered in Beijing. The unofficial part of the conference, attended by representatives of non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, wrapped up today in Wairo, which is over 30 miles away from Beijing. To get a sense of what the conference has been like so far, we called Vicky Kuei, who reports for WHYY Radio and NPR. She's traveled to China before with her father, a doctor who grew up in China and then emigrated to the United States. Vicky Kuei has been staying at a hotel in Beijing. I asked her if it's been difficult to get back and forth between Beijing and Wairo.
I felt very strongly that we should not be in a journalist hotel. And when I got to the airport, they tried to tell me I had to go to one, but I refused, and we came to this hotel instead. It had been difficult because, first of all, you have to hire a taxi if you don't take a shuttle. And the shuttles only run at certain times, so most of the time I've been getting up early in the morning, going down and haggling with the taxi drivers, to get them to lower their rates, because basically when they knew the conference came, they raised all their rates. So in each and every morning, my producer, Laura, has been upstairs kind of embarrassed, while I'm down there saying, no, 151 and no more. So, but it has been difficult because on top of that, Beijing is a city of construction and bicycles. Everywhere you look, there is construction. And then there's a lot of traffic on top of it. And sometimes you sit in traffic and you don't move for, a good 25 minutes. And it is frustrating.
Vicky, why do you feel so strongly about not staying in a journalist hotel?
Because I know the Chinese government, and I also felt that I didn't want to be in a place where everything was set up for me. I also knew that if I were in a journalist hotel, the workers there would be a lot more, how do I put this? The workers would not be as free with their ideas, and they wouldn't talk to me as a person, they would talk to me as a journalist. And here, it wasn't until really a couple of days ago that people started calling me, saying, hello, journalist Vicky, or journalist Kuei. A lot of the women who work in the hotel have been very friendly, and they have opened up to me.
I think there's about 4,000 journalists at the conference. Has it been very frustrating to be in a place where there's at least 3,999 other people on the story?
I didn't realize, I didn't feel how many other journalists there were here until yesterday when Hillary Clinton came to speak at the NGO forum. And I can tell you that we were all standing outside in the pouring rain waiting to get into this building where they had moved her speech to because of the rain. And we went to the side door, and there were a whole bunch of us underneath umbrellas, holding our umbrellas, banging on the door trying to get in. And this Chinese guard said, there's no press entrance. You have to all go through the front. And in front, there was just a sea of colorful umbrellas, all these women wanting to get in to see Hillary Clinton. And so they basically told us you have to push your way through these women and, get up to the balcony. So I was just kind of following some of the other journalists. All of a sudden, some of the international press start pushing from behind, and you know, they're pushing us on top of these other women standing in line. And then the Chinese guards came and they were pushing from the front. And I honestly felt that we were going to, you know, that there was going to be some kind of stampede. And I was holding on to this elderly, not elderly, but an older journalist next to me. And she was a little bit more frail. And I just kept saying, you know, make sure you stay on your feet. Make sure you stay on your feet, because if we trip and we fall here, we're going to be dead. We're going to be trampled. And it was really frightening. I guess that's really when I realized just how many other journalists there were there. And it was pretty ugly.
It's moments like that where you have to ask yourself, how important is it for you to get into the building and hear Hillary Clinton?
It was not that important to me. I can be quite honest about that. It was important to a lot of the women there. And I can say that there were women from every country imaginable standing in line in the rain to see Hillary Clinton. But to me, it was not worth that kind of action. It was really ugly. I honestly feel that it was the ugly side of humanity there occurring.
But did you make it in?
I did, and actually, I was standing outside, and I was pretty frightened, and this Chinese guard saw me, and he let me in. And some of the other journalists, I don't think, liked that, but he did let me in. He kind of just pulled me in, and that kind of thing's been happening a lot, I should say. I have gotten interviews with people here that I know I would not have gotten if I didn't have a Chinese face.
Have many women told you stories about their lives or about the significance of attending this conference for them?
Oh, yeah. Some of them tell me about having saved up for, you know, a couple of years just to be able to come here, you know, having taken a huge financial debt load on just to be able to come. A lot of them tell me that they just wanted to be able to talk to other women to find out, you know, other women activists to find out how they approached a situation in a garment factory or how they approached problems with AIDS in women, that kind of thing. There's been a sense of urgency on the part of many of the women, and it's very common when you're talking with a group of people for somebody to just come up and say, "Hi, I'm such and such, and are you talking about AIDS? Are you talking about this?" You know, it's really been incredible. They're not shy at all, and that's one of the things that I've really liked about this.
What are some of the stories that you've been moved by that other women have told you about their lives?
I talked to a woman who works with women in sub-Saharan Africa. And she was telling me that when she first went to a village, she was attending a birth where a woman died in childbirth. The child made it, and the father named the child Sacrifice. And she said she was deeply hurt, but at the same time she was touched by the fact that he named her Sacrifice and that he acknowledged what had happened to his wife, that kind of thing. And she said then she found out that there were a whole bunch of children in that village that were named Sacrifice. And I was very touched by that. I spoke with a chief of a tribal chief of a village in southwest Nigeria, who told me about this program that she designed to help women there start up their own businesses, because in where she's from, it's tribal custom that the land is handed down from father to son, and women are excluded from owning property. So, but at the same time, they can't get loans from banks because they have nothing to offer as collateral. So she, at one point, gave a group of women from a village part of her salary, which only amounted to about $45 US, to buy some machines that they needed to start a processing plant for cassava and palm oil. And they were a huge success. And then she told them, give your capital gains to another group of women, and they did. And now she's founded this group called the Country Women's Association of Nigeria, And last year they had 4,500 members and loaned about $6.7 million to women in rural, poor villages of Nigeria. And I just thought that was fascinating.
If you're just joining us, my guest speaking to us by phone from Beijing is Vicky Kuei. She's in Beijing covering the Fourth World Conference on Women. Vicky, your father is Chinese. Do people in China assume that you are from China? And is that affecting how you're being treated?
Yeah, they do. They come up to me and they immediately start speaking in Mandarin. And they do assume that I'm Chinese. And yeah, like I said before, I have gotten interviews that I don't think I would have normally have gotten if I didn't have a Chinese face, simply because I think a lot of the Chinese women here are afraid to talk to, some of the international women here. They really don't want to talk to journalists. A lot of journalists have told me they haven't gotten any decent interviews with any Chinese women. And I was able to sit down with a 73-year-old Tibetan woman and talk with her, and I asked her after I was done, why did you do the interview with me? And she was speaking through a translator, and she told me, because you look like my granddaughter. And she gave me a pin. She wanted to give me this pin that she had made and said, because her granddaughter had died, that she wanted me to have the pin because she thought I had probably a piece of her granddaughter's soul. So that was pretty moving, too.
Yeah. Now, I know your grandmother's feet were bound. Did she ever move to the United States, or did she stay in China?
No, she never moved to the United States.
Did you see her feet?
I was very little when I saw her feet. And actually, I remember asking my dad, I was very little, but I remember saying, why does she walk so funny? And she had always been, a foreigner to all of us. And in a very strange way, all of our Chinese relatives have always been sort of foreigners to my sisters and my brother and I. And my mother's side of the family, my mother is Puerto Rican, had always been grandma and grandpa, and an Uncle Vinny and Aunt Magali. So, they've always been strange to us. And I had asked my father, why does she walk so funny? And he had said, well, they did something to her feet when she was young. And went on to say, her feet were bound. And I remember thinking when I was a little girl how horrible. And then reading about it later on and becoming absolutely engrossed in reading all I could and actually getting out sheets one day and cutting them up and trying to figure out how this happened.
Did you see her feet?
Yes, I did.
What did they look like?
They were swollen. And this was years later after being unbound. She still didn't walk right. They were broken.
As we record now, it's nighttime for you in Beijing. What are your plans for tomorrow?
I am taking my producer, Laura Jackson, to the Great Wall of China. She's never been to China ever before. She definitely wants to see the Great Wall, and I cannot let her leave China without seeing the Great Wall and at least the Forbidden City. I definitely want her to see that, because all she's seen so far are the traffic jams, the construction, the bamboo scaffolding, and, the hassles we've had with certain people here. And I want her, I have a feeling that I don't think she has a good impression of China, and it's really important to me that she sees some of the beauty as well.
Vicky Kuei spoke to us from Beijing. She's a reporter for WHYY Radio and NPR. We'll hear from a woman who studies women's movements around the world after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest, Amrita Basu, is the editor of a book commissioned by the Ford Foundation about women's movements in 23 countries. It's called The Challenge of Local Feminisms. She's a professor of political science and women's and gender studies at Amherst College. Both of her parents are from India and worked for the UN. Her mother was a member of the UN Secretariat and helped organize the first UN World Conference on Women, which was held in Mexico in 1975. Basu has attended two of the four UN World Conferences on Women. She says these international conferences have shown that there is no monolithic model of feminism. Women in developing countries have different needs than women in industrialized countries. I asked her if she thinks this realization works against the sense of unity you'd expect international conferences to produce.
I think in the past that women from the post-colonial world in particular found the notion of global sisterhood to be extremely oppressive because it assumed a sameness in the problems of women. And I think most often because it denied attention to problems of class inequality, poverty, imperialism that women in the post-colonial world experienced. So I think the positive aspect of this development is that feminism has become more local, or at least more locally articulated, that although there are certain broad themes that run through women's movements in various parts of the world, women have been able to address them in very different ways, sometimes in the context of social movements which are inclusive of men or often even led by men, sometimes in the context of environmental movements. It's very striking, for example, in India or in Kenya, that the green movement, movements against deforestation, have been a very important form of arena in which women can express opposition to gender inequality.
You've been studying women's movements around the world. Why are you studying them? What are you looking for?
Well, I suppose that most scholarship is autobiographical, and in part, I became interested in this question from through the influence of my mother, who was a very strong and still is a very strong and independent woman. And she influenced me, I think, both in her own attempt to resist social conventions as she was growing up. She refused to have an arranged marriage. She fought hard to continue her education. She ended up working for the United Nations in the branch on women's rights. So she was a very important influence in my life, and my sister and I accompanied her as she attended conferences on women's rights and human rights around the world as we grew up.
Earlier this week in China, when Hillary Clinton spoke, she referred to a practice in India that's known as dowry death. She said, "It's a violation of human rights when women are doused with gasoline, set on fire, and burned to death because their marriage diaries are deemed too small." What do you know about this practice?
Well, it's still extremely pervasive. This is the practice that really brought into being the women's movement. The first forms of organized women's protest took place in opposition to dowry deaths. In fact, the Indian newspapers would carry accounts of women who had accidentally burned to death while cooking because kerosene had spilled on their saris and they had caught on fire. And some women's organizations in the late 1970s began to investigate these cases and found that, of course, these were not accidents at all, but these were cases of women's having been murdered. The early attempts of the women's movement in the late 70s and early 1980s was to try and make public these very privatized actions. Apparently, what would often happen is that the in-laws, often the mother-in-law was complicit in this, along with her son-in-law, would both be present at the time and would douse the daughter-in-law, the bride, with kerosene and kill her. And this often took place after a long period in which they had been harassing her, claiming that the dowry they had received at the time of marriage was insufficient and demanding that she return to her family to get a larger dowry. What was also shocking is that very often these young women would return to their families and would tell them that they were being harassed, tortured, and their parents would advise their daughters to go back and tell them things would get better, which of course they didn't. So the tactic that women's organizations used was of shaming families publicly, of going out outside their homes, of calling for them to come out on the streets and naming them so that it was no longer possible for them to find refuge in their homes. What I think is disturbing, however, is that although the women's movement is very active around this issue, dowry deaths continues to be an extremely important problem in North India and now in parts of South India as well.
Now, is dowry death illegal?
Yes, it is. In fact, the practice of the dowry is illegal, but the laws against dowry are so filled with loopholes that they've been utterly worthless.
I guess that's part of what international women's movements are up against, is even when there is a law on the books that makes it a criminal action to practice a crime against a woman, whether it's rape or murder, it doesn't mean that the practice is going to end.
That's absolutely right. And I think these international conferences have come under a lot of criticism for being expensive affairs, for being inefficient means of getting work done. But I think that one of the things that they do is to galvanize attention on a global scale to these continuing horrors that women face.
You know, one of the themes now in the international women's movement is that women's rights are a part of human rights.
Right.
How close do you think we are to having some kind of international agreement on that?
I think, depressingly, we're still quite far from that. The fact that the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women has still not been ratified suggests that, when that puts forward some basic women's rights. So I think that, one of the things that has been striking to me in reading through the report, particularly of the Human Development Report, which was published by the UNDP, is that in very large parts of the world, women have not achieved many fundamental legal rights, the right to own property, the right to travel without the permission of their husbands outside of their countries. So I think we tend to assume that those basic legal rights have been achieved, and we can go on from there, and that's still not the case.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Amrita Basu is the editor of The Challenge of Local Feminisms. She's a professor at Amherst College. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the music of China's most popular rock star. And we talk with choreographer and dancer Bill T. Jones about his life and work. His piece, Still Here, grew out of his own and other people's experiences with illness and death. Jones is HIV positive. He lost his partner to AIDS. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill T. Jones, has a beautiful body. He shaped it as a runner. He was very fast. And then in college, he reshaped his body to dance. He's now internationally known as the co-founder of Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane & Company. Zane, who was Jones' partner on and off the stage, died of AIDS in 1988. Jones, who is HIV positive, draws on the experiences of people with life-threatening illness in his piece, Still Here. It will be shown on PBS in December. Jones has a new memoir called Last Night on Earth. He has this to say about his body during his early days as a dancer. My feet were big, flat, and did not have high, supple arches. I was not lithe and swan-like. My buttocks were hard and pronounced. My chest was barrel-shaped, and it jutted forward. My carriage was low, grounded, and round, not pulled up and elongated. Jones liked to say this is the body he got from his parents.
For lack of a better word, sometimes I glibly say it comes from 300 years of selective breeding. Now, this is the body of people who loaded potatoes onto trucks all day. This is the body that a woman who could carry the child into the day of labor and be out working in potatoes and then go to the hospital and be back in the field 2 weeks later. That's the body. Now, yes, it's true. This is the body that was trained as an athlete and the body that was finding its way in a world that was changing its appraisal of what a black body is and what a man's body is. And this body, I use it now as part of that discourse. When to take the shirt off, when to look you and the audience in the eye and move the hips suggestively, when to close down. These things, I use my body as a kind of a symbol, a cipher, that is a proving ground on some levels. And it's an aging body.
I learned a lot about you from the book that I really had no idea about. I mean, I knew that you came to dance fairly late, that you weren't classically trained as a child. But I learned that your parents were migrant workers mm-hmm. when you were young. Mm-hmm. How many years did you travel around before settling?
Well, you have to realize that the family is a very big group. It starts, my mother had her first child when she was 15, and then she had 13 more. So by the time she and my father started migrating, I don't think I was even born. And I was born in 52, and they stopped migrating in about 55 and became what at that time was called stagnants. In other words, itinerant workers who have decided to settle down in one area but have not been in an area for enough years to be considered residents. I went to school K through 12 in the upstate community of Wayland, New York, Steuben County, where my father was picking potatoes and fruits and vegetables. And I think the business sort of folded, it ended as I said, migrating in 55, and they stopped doing the gathering of fruits and vegetables probably in the early 60s.
So were you, were most of your friends when you were very young the children of other migrant workers?
No, there were not that many other migrant workers in the area. This is, I think, central to who I have become as a person, and I think who I am as an artist, in that my dad decided to become a black Yankee. He forfeited all of the cultural soil of the South for economic opportunities and educational opportunities for his children, and that was part of the great American story. Suddenly, I was speaking a language that my parents did not speak. Suddenly, I had values that they could not have. Suddenly I had a point of reference culturally and so on that they could not have, and they had been told it would all be good for me, and yet they were no longer even able to assess what it was and who it was I was becoming. And that's one reason in Last Night on Earth I spend a lot of time talking about them and the colorful and often painful history that took me from being the son of a migrant worker to a young social dropout in the 60s, even though how can you drop out of something that was never really yours to begin with, and moved on to becoming an artist working in a very esoteric art form called modern dance.
One of the differences between you and your parents, your parents, or at least your mother, was a real believer. I mean, she was a fundamentalist and was very and is very much guided by her faith. And I was wondering if you ever shared her faith.
Do I share? Yes, I share it right now. I don't need Jesus Christ, but I do have a feeling that there is something that unites you and I, Terry. I believe that there is intelligence in the universe. I don't believe in sin, but I do believe that there is a consciousness, spirit, if you like, that does unite us all. And I am, as I grow deeper and as a man and as I age, and I'm trying to understand what is going on here and what is the meaning of it. And I think that this is something that she has always understood. And so I listen more closely to her prayers now. Not so much about Jesus, but about what it means to live. What do you need to believe to live?
Wasn't part of her prayers at one time that you would cease being gay and become straight?
You know, I never remember her praying that. No, I must say, she never prayed that. She always wanted us to see the truth of life. Now, I'm sure if you pressed her, she would rather I was married with children. But, you know, when Uncle Tom's Cabin was going on, every night she toured with me and she would stand up on stage and it was a section I gave her. My intention was to demonstrate a form that I thought was on the border of theater and ritual. I was demonstrating it in a postmodern context, that of a dance performance. But for her, what she was doing was offering a benediction that evening. And I'm very proud of that. And she'd say, "Oh, Lord," she'd call out to the Lord as I'm standing next to her improvising, dancing. Aid my son in doing whatever it is he thinks he's doing up here. And I think that's...
That's funny.
Yes, she would. She would. She's there for me. And she believes that, you know, there was nudity in Uncle Tom's Cabin. I remember her saying, "Well, son, you know, you never see pictures of the Savior. He's always half-dressed, too." You know, I mean, she would translate everything in a way that she would understand it. And she is there. She's behind me. And believe me, with all of the controversy that's been, you know, floating around me in the last year, she stood strong. And my mother is, you know, confirmed believer that men are men and women are women and that we're here to have children. I mean, she herself said, "You got to have children until the Lord shuts them off." She doesn't believe in abortion. She doesn't believe in all. She's had 13, 14 kids. But she would not get in the way of my life. This has not been easy. We've had to talk a lot and, quote, soul search a lot. It was very difficult for me to get my mother to say the word gay initially, even to say the word AIDS. But it's an ongoing, dear relationship.
Didn't you do an onstage dialogue with her once?
Yes, I did. I did. It was, as a matter of fact, the first prototype for a piece which found its way into Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was called Faith, and we did it at a dance festival out in Los Angeles, and I asked her to read her favorite passage from the Bible, and then I was going to ask her questions about faith, my premise being faith is a slave religion. When blacks came to this country, they were forced to get down and at gunpoint and accept Jesus Christ. And I said to her, you know, how is this possible that you could believe in a religion that was forced on us at gunpoint? And she said, "Well, you know, we were over in Africa worshiping trees and rocks. And if it took slavery to introduce us to the true master, then slavery was worth it." I thought that was a very strong thing to her here, but from the reading I have done and the investigation I've done with many people of faith and people of color, this is their faith is unflappable. And that was my point, not so much to tackle the historical validity or the political correctness of what she said, but to get in touch with that elusive quality, which is called faith, which I think many of us, myself included, intellectuals, late 20th century creators, are lacking. An infrastructure of belief in something greater than ourselves, or maybe which in fact defines ourselves.
My guest is dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones. So do you think that the passion that your mother has always felt in her faith is the kind of passion you brought to dance?
That I bring to dance?
Yeah, that you bring to dance. Mm-hmm.
I would like it to be the passion I bring to every waking moment. Now, excuse me if I get too metaphorical or metaphysical, but it's true. Terry, life right now for me literally is from breath to breath. Anxiety wells up in my chest. When you ask me questions, when I leave this, the next appointment, what will my health be like next week, next year? And it's about every moment finding a way to deal with anxiety, reaffirming one's social agenda, one's life agenda, and getting on to the next moment. That is how I view things now.
How is your health? I know you are.
I am asymptomatic, and mm-hmm. I could run around the block right now if I needed to.
Mm-hmm. To me, anxiety means tension, and tension always settles in part of my body. Mm. You know, I have my shoulder tension, my neck tension, my headache tension, the jaw tension, you know.
Yeah. Well, I have it right in the center of my chest. It's fear, and you find yourself not breathing, hyperventilating on the top.
Right.
And making silly choices.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes being angry when silence would have been best. That sort of thing. Or making a snap decision when to postpone it would have been best. That's what tension does for me. It's fear oftentimes.
Well, when the tension settles in your chest or when you find yourself breathing differently, how does that affect you as a dancer? I mean, like when my tension settles in my neck, at least I don't have to be dancing.
Right. Well, you know, in the book, I talk a good deal about what it was like to be a runner. And when you run, and I was a sprinter, and I was pretty good. And there's an instance where I'm talking about the crunch of the cinders, and suddenly you see the tape, and there's this thing behind your rib cage, between your lungs, that goes click and says, now. And then there's a gush of adrenaline, and one thrusts forward, and there's that tape snapping across the pectorals. That is the same thing I feel now on the stage. It is in the middle of an intense conversation like we're having, the thing that says, this is it, Bill. There's no moment but this moment. Give it. Go for it. This is the last moment. This is the first moment. And that is where my dancing comes from at its best, that place right behind the sternum and between the lungs.
And so that pressure in the chest or whatever disappears, the fear stress disappears while you're performing.
Oh, no, it turns into a beautiful substance, radiant, that goes up to the cerebral cortex and down to the sexual organs. And if it's really good, it comes out into the space around you and others feel it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones, and he's written a new memoir called Last Night on Earth. For many years, you ran your company with your partner, Arnie Zane, and he was not a dancer at all. I mean, he was more a photographer, and I think thought of himself as a photographer. But when you met and had a relationship and formed the company, you worked together as, as dancers. What was it like to work with you, to work with someone who wasn't a dancer?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, Last Night on Earth, I make a great point out of saying, describing the era in which we started working. Everything was up for grabs.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful time. Now, it might have been totally undisciplined and what have you, but we were the students of a person like Yvonne Rainer, who had done a brilliant work that said, called Trio A, that was danced almost entirely by untrained performers. We were studying a form called contact improvisation developed by a remarkable dancer, Steve Paxton, that said that any two bodies could dance together. I remember having a contact jam with a 98-pound ex-ballerina. I weigh 180 pounds, and she had me through counterlever up on her back. It was life-altering. So it was with Bill and Arnie. And Arnie was an artist through and through. Any work, as soon as he understood it conceptually, he could begin to claim it as his own. So he could roll quicker than anybody I knew. He had a kind of pugnacious, low-to-the-ground sense of movement, and he was a fifth-level karate practitioner. And his work was very much about slashing and making strong shapes in the air. My long body, my wiggles, and more dancerly way of moving made a nice counterpoint to this peculiar guy. And you looked at these two men, Bill and Arnie, and you knew obviously there was something that this grappling, and a lot of what we did was very artful grappling, represented that was deeper. It was about them. And then you thought, well, who are they? Case in point, we went to Berlin and we performed a work of ours, Blaubelt Mountain, in which I build, there's a brick wall in the back, and Arnie takes it apart and builds it down the center of the stage, and I dance freely. We were given the German Critics Award. They said the work was a brilliant depiction of the struggle between blacks and whites in America. We didn't think so. We thought we were doing what we did. We were being Bill and Arnie on stage and artfully grappling, but what they saw was something that I no longer disown. They saw something. As much as we were black and white men, they also saw that we were homoerotic, a word that I had never used before. It made us think, oh, is that what they're seeing? They're seeing our private life. And then we became more self-conscious and began to play with what they were seeing and the expectation that was brought by our bodies and the combination of two disparate bodies. And it even informs the way I choose my dance company now. I'm looking for that same kind of a volatile, insightful mix of the unexpected.
Bill T. Jones, he has a new memoir called Last Night on Earth. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the Senate Ethics Committee's decision on Bob Packwood?
Well, we'll be hearing more from NPR's Nina Totenberg on the Ethics Committee's decision yesterday. It's unanimous vote to recommend the expulsion of Senator Packwood. And we'll also be hearing from the chairman of the committee, Republican Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who called Senator Packwood's conduct offensive, degrading, and illegal. Also on today's program, Tom Jelton reports on the present U.S. policy in Bosnia, which is to use enough air power, it seems, to make the Bosnian Serbs go to the bargaining table.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Music critic Milo Miles recently attended one of the first concerts in this country by Chinese rock star Choi Jian. He's a youth hero in China. His songs were chanted by students at Tiananmen Square, and he's been periodically suppressed by the government. Over here, he's virtually unknown outside the Chinese community. But Milo predicts that with Choi Jian's command of both rock's music and attitude, he will not stay secret long.
You never know what to expect from non-English rock bands. There's often a lot of cliches, a lot of random enthusiasm, and a lot of feeling that it's not bad, but still. This is resolutely not the case with China's Choi Jian. About three songs into the show I saw in Boston, it hit me that this guy was not messing around. He was a whiz musician who had discovered his idiom. He reaffirms your faith that there are just some people born to rock. Choi was born, period, in 1961, and by the time he was 20, he was a school trumpeter in the Beijing Symphony Orchestra. But he was infected by the music of capitalist running dogs like Bruce Springsteen, The Police, and Talking Heads. He began playing electric guitar, and in 1986, he wrote his first rock song. This is a sample from a live version. The title translates as, "It's Not That I Don't Understand," and it's about the dangerous excitement of having an open mind. Choi is a passionate advocate of free thinking, but he notes that the world changes for those who choose freedom, and it keeps on changing, faster and faster. As he puts it, "I suddenly feel the world in front of me is somewhere I am not." One highlight of his concert was "A Piece of Red Cloth," a smooth mid-tempo tune with a delicate trumpet part. It used to have the more provocative title, "The Red Cloth Blinds Me," and Choi has played it with a red bandana tied around his eyes. The reference to the communist flag still can't be missed. Includes numerous delightful sing-along choruses and catchy doo-doo-doo chants in his music, but his flair for tricky, fluid arrangements is what eventually knocks you out. Chinese instruments and folk song forms can sound shrill and brittle to Westerners, but Choi has learned from Sting and David Byrne, who throw all sorts of odd tones into their songs without missing a beat. Choi Jian ended his Boston show with the all-out rouser called "Rock and Roll on the New Long March," and he definitely takes the long view. His first big hit was the tune "Nothing to My Name," and he joked on stage that now we have 1 cent. He may have meant that Chinese capitalism was soulless, but it also meant his world conquest had just gotten started. I may not have seen rock and roll future that night, but I sure saw an outstanding example of its present.
Milo Miles writes about music from Cambridge. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Thanks to producer Laura Jackson in Beijing and Nightingale Productions. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of a newly discovered novel by Louisa May Alcott, A Long Fatal Love Chase. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.